Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, this is Joshua David Stein. You're listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, Half Hour. Today, we have my favorite lineup of guests that I think we've had this whole program, and one of my favorite topics, the very divisive issue of fried chicken, which you might not think is divisive if you don't think about it, and once you do think about it, it divides people. Normally, we start off the show with a segment called Food Poem in an English Accent. It has a theme song.
Food poem in an English accent.
But today, we're really lucky because we have a food poem read by the guy who wrote it. And that also has a theme song.
Food poem read by the guy who wrote it.
And that guy is on the line with us. His name is Lin Din. Lin, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me clearly?
I can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes, fine.
Where are you?
Philadelphia.
Oh, lovely. My hometown. Lin.
All right.
Looking for poems about food, a couple of weeks ago, found your poem, Eating Fried Chicken, and I've been waiting for a chance to hear it read. It's a wonderful poem and addresses a lot of the issues I want to talk about today. Do you mind reading it for us?
Sure. Just tell me when to start.
Start.
All right, eating fried chicken. I hate to admit this, brother, but there are times when I'm eating fried chicken, when I think about nothing else but eating fried chicken, when I utterly forget about my family, honor, and country, the various blood debts you owe me, my past humiliations and my future crimes. Everything, in short, but the crispy skin on my fried chicken. But I'm not altogether evil. There are also times when we refuse to lick or swallow anything that's not generally available to mankind, which is, when you think about it, absolutely nothing at all. And no doubt that's why apples can cause riots, and meat brings humiliation, and each gasp of air will fill one's lungs with gunpowder and smoke.
It's a striking poem. Lin, is there anything you want to say about that poem? It comes from American Tats, right? A collection
yeah.
Came out in the early 2000s.
The root of it is fairly banal, because I was living in Italy at the time, and it was very hard to get real good fried chicken. It was impossible to get fried chicken there. So my wife and I were making it at home, and we made a disaster of it. And for some reason, it provoked this poem, which is a lot more elusive than its source.
It's a work of poetry, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Lin, thank you so much for reading this poem.
All right, man.
Have fun in Philadelphia.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Okay. Cheers. So before we go to our next guest, I want to talk a little bit about why I chose to focus on fried chicken today. Last week for the New York Observer, where I'm a restaurant critic, I reviewed a restaurant that recently opened in the Lower East Side called Birds and Bubbles. And the birds, in that case, are fried chickens, and the bubbles are champagne. I did not like the restaurant, both on grounds of the execution and on philosophical grounds. And this is how I started the review. What to do about Birds and Bubbles, a new subterranean restaurant that sells, as the name indicates, fried chicken and champagne. Gotta go, I guess, but man, I don't want to. After the summer Ferguson and Eric Garner and 16,000 devastating words by Ta-Nehisi Coates, race relations burned bright in my mind. My white mind, but nonetheless mine. More fried chicken. Here cheekily paired with champagne. I get it. It's high-low, or as a restaurant says, an elevated take on Southern classics. But really, is that all it is? Fried chicken is, when considered, one of America's great freighted foods. For hundreds of years made primarily by black women in the South, it still bears a racial connotation under that regional one. Even as fried chicken has become a deracinated trend in the city, I don't think one can entirely divorce all the ugly cultural breading that has clung to its flesh. When, as it is at Birds and Bubbles, forced to play the low card in the oat-low split, when Birds and Bubbles itself builds a shtick on irony and reinforcement of the hierarchy, the unholy taint of ancient enmity, at worst, and modern privileged blitheness at best, grows into an unignorable stench. Those would be my philosophical, sociological objections to the restaurant. I also didn't like the fried chicken, although the shrimp etouffee was delicious. But I think, as I mentioned in the piece, sort of triangulating fried chicken into that kind of subjugated part of the binary is problematic, especially since it is a restaurant catering to kind of, I'm not sure it matters who it's catering to. And I'm not sure it entirely matters who is cooking it. But to help me answer all of those questions and to talk a little bit about fried chicken and the history of fried chicken is a historian, author, my favorite author writing about food and race and regionality that I've ever read. His name is Michael Twitty. His website is Afro Culinaria, and you also might know him as Kosher Soul. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good Yontif to you.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually about 30 minutes away from teaching high school kids Judaism, so I'm wearing both my hats today. So you got me on a good semat Torah.
Oh, one is a yarmulke, and I don't know what the other one is.
It's my curls, brother. It's my curls.
Michael, so I got a lot of pushback. I feel like I get a lot of pushback whenever I talk about race or cultural appropriation in restaurants. But a lot of the pushback was, are you kidding? Fried chicken is racist? And I have a hard time saying, yes, it is racist. And on another level, I have a hard time saying, no, it's absolutely not racist. I think it's a pretty complicated food. And I was wondering, have you thought about the role that fried chicken has played in Southern cuisine and now what it plays in presentations of Southern cuisine outside of the South?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when the Ferguson episode went down, I started my blog post on Ferguson with the picture that was sent around the internet of the meme of Michael Brown being surrounded by pieces of fried chicken, a bucket of KFC. You can try to divorce things like that from their past context, but these things die hard. And as long as those things are out there, this is an issue you have to deal with. So I think that I think this generation and maybe slightly half of the one before it, and certainly those that will come after, those for whom their first president, only president, has been Barack Obama, will have a hard time understanding some of the, as my friend Tony Tipton Martin puts it, these Jemima codes that, you know, I was born into the world with, that continue to exert influence. And being someone who has taught, you know, teenagers of multiple ages throughout his career, I have to say that because of his history and humor and our contemporary pop culture, some of these stereotypes about various groups will still come down to the next generation, and they will still manifest. But the issue is, do they understand them? So I think maybe the problem is that folks are going, I don't get it, but really deep down inside they do.
I mean, for me, there's two issues, right? There's how fried chicken has been used as a racial stereotype, right? On one hand, with which you call the Jemima Code. And then on the other hand, there's the actual fried chicken itself, kind of appreciated or presented with love or however you want to say it. I don't think that the woman who's a very nice lady, Sarah Simmons, who runs this place, is playing into the Jemima Code, but I don't also think that that's a root of my, I guess my objection with it. I mean, it's just a really thorny kind of.
Is it because it's like a high and low situation? I feel like when I heard about this, that I read your review, and I saw the fried chicken and champagne. I was like, well, what is that about?
Right.
What is that for? I really didn't get it. I was like, well, what are you trying to say about fried chicken? Fried chicken to me does not symbolize, not you, but in terms of pairing it with champagne, fried chicken to me symbolizes the traditional African-American Sunday dinner, which to me is like a banquet for God.
Right.
It's a time of connecting with community, family, and faith. And I don't see it. And it was a special food for our past generations. They didn't just eat this food every day. This was something that it cost money. It cost a lot of effort and time, and it was special. You fed it to your preacher. It was not something that was. So if this pairing is intended to reflect that sort of elevation that it had in our traditional culture, that's one thing. But if it's like, you know, slave food and the drink of kings, I don't know about that.
Right. I would think it rests somewhere in the middle ground, right? I mean, I do think that she, the chef, I mean, and I also am not sure that intent is really the most important thing here either. I mean, one of the pieces I read thinking about it, and I read it at the time, was Ezra Klein's response to Coates' essay about compound interest, where you can still be the beneficiary of sort of entrenched racism, even if you aren't racist yourself. It's the idea that you've been, the system has been set up for some people to succeed in some ways and other people not. So it's like she's presenting this fried chicken and she has a privilege to do that in this way. And yeah, you're right. For me, there's the most problematic part of it is what that says about fried chicken and how we think about fried chicken. I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, well, the flavors of champagne go with the flavors of fried chicken. I think especially because what you said at the top of the show, it's a much more, it's really playing with, you know, with fire. It's a very, I think it is, it's a freighted food. From your standpoint as a culinary historian as well, who have been the people in this, you know, now, as I'm sure you know, fried chicken is a trend in New York, right? Everyone has
right.
a fancy fried chicken. It's
fried chicken and donuts, fried chicken and waffles, fried chicken and this, but you know,
right.
What, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah. Tell me your thoughts. Let me break that into two questions. First question, who has traditionally made fried chicken, in the South?
Black men and black women. And I want to make sure we get that term black men in there making food, because I got to tell you, back in the first days of slavery, the first century and a half of slavery, I guess, black men were the chefs and the cooks in plantation kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
But see, black men could run away if they didn't have wives and children. You get what I'm saying?
I get what you're saying.
So they wanted cooks who were able to, you know, be chained down because of family connections.
Right.
And so therefore, that's what we had. So we had black men and black women who became famous for this. If you read Dr. Psyche Williams-Forson's book, Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs, there were black women who were selling fried chicken to passengers on the train, making money, using that money to empower themselves and build communities. And there were certainly black men who wrote cookbooks who were demonstrating their ability to make chicken. And this chicken was going to New York, Philadelphia, with people who were freedom seekers. So this is also a story of empowerment as well. I think we're so used to the ethnic joke that we forget about the fact that no, when you are surviving enslavement and surviving Jim Crow, everything that helps you live to the next day is resistance.
Right, and I think you just pinpointed exactly my why I feel so uneasy about it. So we think of fried chicken here, I mean New York, and by we, I guess I mean the restaurant critical establishment and foodies. We think of it as comfort food. Like, isn't that just great comfort food? It makes you feel so good. It's, you know, nothing better than fried chicken or fried chicken and waffles or whatever. And that is such a blithe misuse. It's just using something which has so much more history that we don't – it's not ours. It's not ours to forget, you know, to just say, oh, that's a delicious yeah, it's a delicious fried chicken.
Let me play with what you just said. I think it's a step further. Here we are we're in the shadow of soul food junkies. We're in the shadow of a larger conversation about culinary justice and access and corner stores versus whole foods and food justice and people like me, for example, who definitely inherited the big bone gene, who, you know, cannot, you know, indulge in fried chicken every day lest our hearts explode. And yet you have another group of people who have not inherited a history of chronic hypertension, high blood pressure, et cetera, that comes from not only stress, but not only comes from diet. I think that's only a part of the story. But, you know, there are one of the things in my work I continually stress is that we actually have theories, which I think will remain theories as long as people are scared to talk about it, about the Middle Passage. And its result was that folks who survived that Middle Passage retained the most sodium. They retained other minerals in the body, which gave us this lovely sort of like evolutionary bottleneck, which guarantees the majority of African Americans can't eat the same way that their white brethren can.
Right, and
on the one hand, you got these young white millennials and hipsters going, oh, bacon, 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 fried chicken, fried chicken, fried chicken, amp on the cheese, and we're sitting back going, no, because that's going to kill me.
Right.
And that's not where my community needs to be. And yet, they're taking this comfort food angle largely from not only people of color, but to poor people in general. These are the soothing foods of poverty and plebeian existence. So there's this really weird sort of like, okay, so you can indulge, but I can't. And part of the privilege is not only social, it's biological.
To end, do you think there can ever be, do you think you can serve fried chicken in a fancy restaurant up here in New York or any sort of bourgeois place with it being respectful? Or is that something that is just, even though it tastes good, it can taste delicious, it is not a privilege to claim that one can claim on morally justifiable grounds?
I think that you can, but I think that you also have to be willing to embrace a certain clarity of mind and history when you do that. You have to kind of like always represent the story. You have to always sort of know from whence you came. And I think that this is a bigger part of our discussion on food and ethics and culinary culture and ethics, that we can no longer just simply try on other people's cuisines and wear them in good fun and eat them in good fun without sort of having a context and connection to people. And once we start doing that, we will have a better and more informed plate.
Michael, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. I've always wanted to sit down and chat, and I'm happy that we had the chance to do it now.
Without a bias, not a problem.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with the musical stylings of Corn Mo. This is the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour. Half hour.
You are listening to Moonless Sky by Eric Maltz.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
Hi, this is Joshua David Stein. You are listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. And now is the time for our musical guest. And our musical guest today is Corn Mo, who is a man of many talents. Let's list them all. He is a member of 357 Lover. He just finished up a tour in a Bee Gees metal band. And Corn Mo, anything else you want to add to that?
And I finished up a tour with a nerdcore hip-hop MC.
Named?
MC Frontalot and Dr. Awkward.
Good. So I've known Corn Mo for 10 or 12 years.
At least.
I used to volunteer with the Bindlestiff Family Circus with our musical guest last week, or 2 weeks ago, Mark DeZula.
Oh, yeah.
And that was back when it was on the Lower East Side, and we were all young and more attractive. Corn Mo, I'm going to ask you to play a song that was referenced last week for the Tavern on the Green. This is a song you wrote about Tavern on the Green. Tell us a little bit about it.
The other Bindlestiff friend of mine, Magic Brian, we would do a New Year's Eve show at Parkside Lounge every year where I would make my famous ribs, which were made of pork, but I also made kale ribs for the vegan friends.
I didn't know kale had ribs.
Well, you take the leaves off, just leave the stalk, but just a little bit of you put a little bit of leaves on it, because then it gives a little more like
taste.
Gristle.
Oh, yeah.
If you were like a vegan who liked gristle.
Yeah.
And then I put my sauce in it. And then I also made a mac and cheese. And that would be my three things that I would bring for the New Year's Eve show. And I told Magic Brian, I was like, man, I need to write a new New Year's Eve song so we don't sing Auld Lang Syne. I want everybody to sing this.
This is a new Auld Lang Syne.
This is a new Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah.
And the backstory, I talk about doing Cardinals. When I first moved to New York with my friends from Texas, we were on an art collective together. We did this thing called cardinaling, where you would set a beer bottle down, and then you tapped the table, like this. There's a cardinal for the first time, and you drink it.
Our listeners at home, he's tapping the table and then his nostrils.
Yeah, it's very cryptic of how you do it, and then the other person has to exactly do what you do, and you do it four or five times, and then if you mess up, you have to drink the whole beer and start all over again. But if you pass, you say, once a cardinal, always a cardinal. I have no idea what it means, but yeah. We did all the time, and then we grew up and stopped doing it.
Yeah, you can reinstate that tradition. Let's hear the song.
All right. Going out with my friends tonight. 15 cardinals without a fight. When you ask me, where have you been? I reply, Tavern o' the Green.
I have to ask, did you used to actually go to Tavern on the Green?
I've never been to Tavern on the Green. It's too expensive.
Next song.
Oh, next song. All right. This next one is about my Aunt Lily, who's very... She was very, very... Well, she's still around. She's in a nursing home now. She's a real sweet lady. She's the last of my grandmother's sisters is still alive. And
where?
Kentucky. Kate is Kentucky. And she was very lazy. My grandfather would... She would call my grandfather and ask my grandfather where her shoes were when they were at her house. And my grandfather would go, I don't know where your shoes are. And then he'd hang up on her. And I go, who's that? Lily? God damn it. I wish she'd stop calling. And then she went to a nursing home on her own volition. And my cousin Jimmy, who's a preacher in near Atlanta, said, hey, Mama, I don't think you want to go to a nursing home. They're going to take it out of your Social Security check. She said, nah, I don't want that. So she stayed out. The only reason she wanted to go to a nursing home is because she's so lazy and she wanted somebody to... But she's a sweet lady.
She's just a lazy,
yeah,
sweet lady.
Yeah, she's just a lazy, sweet lady.
Yeah.
Not lazy in a... She worked all her life. But in some sense, she was lazy. But she just wanted someone to take care of her, like a nurse, all the time. And that's what her dream goal was in her late years.
Who is this song? Is this song addressed to someone, or is it just a narrative?
Well, here's the thing that she loved to do. She loved to tell people happy birthday. And she would call the local radio station and say, here's a list of all the people's birthdays in the town. I want you to tell everybody happy birthday. Sometimes they'd let her say happy birthday. She would call me on my birthday all the time. Then she forgot because she got older. And I guess maybe she grew out of that hobby. I don't know. But so it's about my great uncles who made moonshine during Prohibition. And they had to stop making it because my great-grandfather said, stop, because your sisters are drinking all the moonshine, and we don't want that. So they had to stop. So it's about my aunt singing happy birthday to my Aunt Hazel, who drank all the moonshine.
Let's hear it.
Happy birthday, don't cry. I saw you last night, your head in your hands. I will never relate about the stranger who drank all the whiskey Sam made. I know it was you. No juice to drive down to Nashville tonight. The syrup's in you. Happy birthday to you. I'm going to the store to get me a Coke. Do you want Mountain Dew? Used to. I started to make a nice birthday cake, and some things you're too lazy for. Ooh. Jerry gets home, go to the store. I lost my good shoes. There's a sale out at Fred's. The shoes that I bought when I was at Fred's were no good to wear, so I'll give them to you. Happy birthday, happy birthday to you.
That is a sad fucking song, Cornmo, I have to say.
Thanks.
Did you ever play that for her?
She hadn't heard it, but my cousin, who's it's his mom, heard it. He loved it.
The preacher.
Yeah, the preacher. He loved it.
Okay, Cornmo, before we go, you do have one thing that you want help with. You fell in love while making a rock opera ballet about the people who gave Frankenstein, or Adam, the monster, his body parts. Is that right?
Yes.
And it's called Severed.
Severed.
And it sounds amazing, just from what I've said. And you had a one-night run at the Highline Ballroom. And now, if this is right, you're looking for funding to do a full run.
That we are.
What would our listeners do? What would you like our listeners do to help you do this?
You can email me at cornmo.com, cornmo@gmail.com, and tell me that you want to invest in our rock opera ballet.
That made you fall in love.
That made me fall in love.
With the choreographer.
With the choreographer. And then we'll go from there. I don't have a PayPal set up to just donate, which I should.
Already.
Already. Because that would be very productive. And getting the money.
That's true.
And I'm not good at that.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But we'll help you.
Okay.
This is Joshua David Stein. You've been listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. That was Corn Mo. I'd like to thank Michael Twitty and Lynn Din as well for being guests earlier on this program. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.